one of the big things, I think there's like, there's a number of things that I think are really important from in, that I've learned on the journey. And first and foremost is to pick something that you're passionate about, but don't expect to be passionate about like every aspect of the business. You have to wear a lot of hats. You have to do the admin stuff and the finance and the marketing and the sales, and you might not like some of it. For me, it's like you need to be passionate about the core aspect of the business, like the product that you're making or the service that you're delivering, and then realize that there are all the jobs that exist in the business to keep it running that you might not be passionate about, and you might have to do them for a little while. So like find something that you're passionate about, but also like don't expect that everything is going to be super exciting.
Welcome to the Brands for a Better World podcast, the podcast that brings you the stories behind people and products building a more just, healthy, and regenerative future for us all. Tune in weekly, and together, we'll learn why these better products and brands were created, how they're helping fix broken systems, and what you can do to support them. My hope is that you'll discover some new brands to love and get some sparks of inspiration that will help you live your best life. Hi, I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow to scale their impact. This podcast is one way we do that. If you like the show, please help it grow by leaving ratings and reviews on your podcast app and by sharing your favorite episodes with your friends. Maybe this will be one of them. We've been lucky enough to book some amazing guests over the years, so I thought we'd take a moment to replay some of our top hits from 2022 to remind you all to dig back into our archives from time to time, because there's a lot of wisdom just waiting for you to tune in. On this episode, we're speaking with Adam Heiner, CEO and co-founder of Pacha, about his experience bringing hard kombucha to the mainstream, his passion for regenerative agriculture, and how he's going all in again on gluten-free bread.
Hello, my name is Adam Heiner. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Pacha. We make organic gluten-free bread, which is also sprouted and wild fermented. So it's super delicious. It's a natural sourdough, really good for digestion. And it also passes for people that are paleo, vegan, really checks all the boxes.
Thanks for joining us, Adam. I'm excited to geek out a little bit more on Pacha because it's new to me, / I really want to try it after looking at all the pictures on your website. But first, before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about your journey towards launching Pacha. So as we've discussed, / looking around in your LinkedIn, I noticed that you started out in selling mortgages at first, but then pretty quickly you found kind of a deep passion for food by launching, you know, you were doing restaurants and catering and now multiple CPG brands. So tell us a little bit about that journey. Like, how did you go from mortgages to this passion for food?
Yeah. So I kind of stumbled into mortgages, moved out to California right after college. And a family friend was one of the top loan officer mortgage brokers out here. So I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to have an opportunity to work for him. And I was there for a couple of years, learned everything about the mortgage business, became kind of his right-hand guy and was doing. I actually launched an online platform for him that is now called RateRabbit. And so learned so much about running a business, building a business online and marketing and managing a team. And then, of course, for some of us that are in my age bracket, we remember the crash of 2007, 2008 in the mortgage market. And that was just a good opportunity for me to kind of think about what I was doing and move out of the mortgage business and eventually, you know, pretty quickly move into food, into something that I was super passionate about. During that whole time, also mirroring that journey, I was, you know, I had moved to California, was learning about organic food, was going to the farmer's market. I was cooking more for myself and becoming really passionate about organic food. So by the time I transitioned out of the mortgage industry, food was like at the forefront of my interest. And yeah, I was lucky enough to also at that time have a friend who was a chef who wanted to expand out of kind of private, smaller catering into like launching a bigger catering company. And so I partnered with a good friend of mine and a chef in LA, and we launched Eco Caters, which was my first business that I owned, as well as my first foray into owning a food-based business.
That's cool. Yeah, I think that's awesome to have that other passion lined up already when something like an economic crisis hits and you're kind of in that moment of trying to decide where to go next. If you already had the food passion, it's an easy yes into that, plus, you know, having connections in the industry. But with that said, having experience in restaurants and catering, I would imagine you were also like had a background in cooking, or you were kind of part of the cooking. But maybe since you had that background in helping set up an online business and such, maybe you came on as more of the business manager. So like, what was that relationship like with your catering / restaurant partners?
Yeah, so that is, you kind of guessed it there. When we started off, I was the business side of, you know, I was running the business, the finance, the front of house. I had a lot of experience just working for catering companies and restaurants in front of house. So I was doing all the front of house management. I kind of accidentally became a wedding coordinator for a while, you know, like because we were coordinating weddings. So I was coordinating weddings and helping brides pick out color patterns and stuff. And so wasn't really what I imagined I would be doing. But at that same time, you know, I was shadowing Nick, my partner, and learning about cooking. And he came from a background in French cuisine from New Orleans and had studied, you know, cooking all over the world, and is one of the most incredible chefs that I know still to this date. And so I was really, really, really lucky to be able to just spend hours and hours and hours with him cooking and learning. And eventually the business, we were operating in San Diego and Los Angeles. Eventually the business grew so much that we couldn't travel back and forth between, you know, every other weekend and like be at every event. So we had times when we had two weddings in LA and two in San Diego on the same weekend. So we really had a need for a head chef in San Diego. And I remember the conversation. I was like, "Hey, Nick, I think I'm ready to head chef San Diego." And he was like, I remember he looked a little concerned, but he was like, "All right, you can do this." You know, like we couldn't afford a really good head chef at that time. And I had been working with him for, you know, a couple of years, like shadowing him every single thing that went out that I had helped him prepare. So, and then I had a lot of phone calls calling him and asking him questions. But over time, I settled into the head chef role in San Diego, and I've been cooking ever since and really love the cooking side, the back end. When I switched over to the back of house and I was working an event back of house and not running the front of house anymore. And then like I was cooking and like we're eating stuff the whole time and like we're snacking and like tasting things. I was like, "What the hell, man? You guys are eating back here all the time. We never get to eat in the front of house." So I was like, "This is awesome." So it was a good transition. I really enjoy the food preparation side.
That's cool. Yeah, I worked in a couple restaurants during college, and I did love that benefit of being on the kitchen side, so that you could be testing out some recipes or whatever, or you could just be like prepping a meal for yourself and kind of like eating it back in the kitchen, whereas the wait staff, like they don't get that luxury, you know, they're out there with all the customers the whole time. But that's cool. Like this is part of why I like to get into people's background a little bit, is because I think it also kind of helps paint the picture of how you got where you are and why you're doing what you're doing, because who would have thought that your experience helping a mortgage company would translate into helping market and grow CPG brands or a catering business or whatever else. But then it's also fun to know that you kind of went from more of a marketing front of house operations kind of role into being a head chef as well. So that's probably a pretty unique path towards a head chef role at a restaurant or catering business. So that's pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a fun transition. And then, you know, in that time, we launched a restaurant, Local Habit, in San Diego. And that was the Local Habit, the 2 years that we owned that restaurant, sat like right in the middle of our catering, the 10 years that I operated the catering company together with Nick. And that was an incredible opportunity as well that really opened the door for what was the future of my CPG career.
Yeah, I think I read that was like Cajun kind of inspired cuisine and craft beer or something like that, right? So was the catering business kind of also Cajun themed, or was this an opportunity to explore a different style?
Yeah, so the restaurant was a little bit of a mix, because we walked into this restaurant space, this opportunity, a friend of ours who we had tried to launch another cafe down at Scripps with, and that didn't pan out. And he had this restaurant in Hillcrest that he needed to shut down and reimagine. So he brought us in to reimagine the restaurant and take over the operations. And he was going to be like a kind of a silent business partner of ours. And we came in, and this restaurant had a massive pizza oven in it. So like right off the bat, we're like, okay, there's this huge oven that we're going to make pizza with, because that's like, we would need a crane and we'd have to like bulldoze the wall to get this thing out of here. So So we knew we would be making pizza and fresh breads. And then we decided, because of Nick's background from New Orleans, we would give it a little bit of a Cajun Creole theme. So it was like a Neapolitan style pizza restaurant with California fresh ingredients and a Cajun Creole like overlay, some of the special dishes and some of the pizzas. But it was a really cool opportunity to really support local farmers. That was like with the catering we would buy from the farmers market, local farmers. But sometimes, you know, with catering, you need 200 pounds of this thing that like the local farmers just don't have, you know, in that moment. But with the restaurant, we could just go to the market, see what was fresh and purchase what was growing in season and really build our menu. Our menu would shift over time and we would build our menu based on what was in season. And it was 100% organic. Everything was made from scratch. So it was like what we were doing on the catering side, but done at like a really high end level. Like we were doing like, you know, a 30-person event every night, basically, or a 60-person event every night. So it was a really cool experience. And through that is where we were also making all of our beverages from scratch. So we made sodas and had those on tap. And we had, you know, one of the most incredible craft beer selections for only having 10 craft beer taps. We were rotating every keg. So I got really in tune with the craft beer scene in San Diego. We went through thousands of different beers over the course of a couple of years. And we also had kombucha on tap, which I made in-house. And we were one of the only places that I had ever seen with kombucha on tap at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of, yeah, I mean, you were pretty early to the kombucha trend, not only from being a restaurant that made your own kombucha, but then as we're kind of talking about this transition, you also ended up launching your own hard kombucha brand. I think it was both regular and hard kombucha called Boochcraft, but you were pretty early in on that trend. So I know that it's pretty difficult sometimes. It's like exciting to sort of start a new category or help grow a category, but it's also daunting to some degree because you have to take the load of like educating the market and kind of building demand for it. So kind of tell me a little bit about that transition from making some of your own kombucha at the restaurant to deciding to launch your own kind of packaged kombucha to then diving deep into the hard kombucha and what some of those challenges were of growing a new category like that.
Yeah. So we sold the restaurant after a couple of years of operating it. And it was on the kind of realm when we had the restaurant going of seeing how well the kombucha sold, thinking like, wow, this could be something. But I kind of tabled it and was like, okay, it's time to focus back on the catering company. And some years went by and I was just sitting with a friend and kicking around business ideas. And he had some, you know, an idea to start growing food in his backyard and selling food out of his backyard. And I'm like, that's not, I mean, that could be fun, but that's not a good business idea. And he was like, all right, well, then what is a good business idea? And it just like sprang back to the forefront of my realm of like a kombucha brewery. That's a good idea. And he was like, oh, okay, well, tell me more about that. And so we started talking about it. This was, you know, we were just hanging out, going out to the bars one night. And so that was where the idea was born. I immediately called my brother-in-law the next day, Andrew, who was like an avid home brewer of beer and just fermentation geek and loved also brewing everything known to man. And I was more of a kombucha brewer. I had brewed beer with him a little bit and he was really a heavy time beer brewer. And called him up and was like, hey man, you need to get involved in this project. We're gonna make this thing happen. So he was like, yep, let's do it, jumped on board. And within a week, I think we were meeting the three of us and funding, putting money into a bank account. And we initially wanted to do a regular kombucha and a hard kombucha. We really, really wanted to, and we still talk about it, but we never actually launched the regular kombucha because as we were growing the idea and building the factory and talking to distributors and retailers, it was very clear that there was plenty of regular kombucha on the shelf and they didn't really need regular kombucha, but hard kombucha, most people at that time had never heard of hard kombucha. There was only the only place in San Diego that sold hard kombucha at the time was Whole Foods. And they had one brand, it was out of Michigan called Unity Vibration. And Unity Vibration really only distributed to like select Whole Foods around and like a couple places in Michigan. So there was only like 50 stores in the whole country that had even heard of hard kombucha at this time. So we were basically the first, you know, hard kombucha brand to really like build a brand and start distributing on a larger level. And so, yeah, we just went for it. We put everything down on hard kombucha. It was really challenging at first because like a lot of people hadn't heard of hard kombucha. And there was also a lot of people that weren't that familiar with kombucha. Being in the bubble that I was in, kombucha was pretty normal thing. And even in California, I was surprised when we would go into craft beer bars and say, hey, we've got this hard kombucha that we're brewing. Like, it's really good. Everyone loves it. They'd be like, hard what? And I was like really surprised to hear like some people didn't even know what kombucha was. So we not only had to build a category, but we had to like educate people about what a beverage was and what it meant and why it was good. And it was funny because the consumer trend was way ahead of the grocery store and the bars. So the bars and grocery stores were very skeptical. But when we would go to events, we'd be at events, at craft beer events, and we would have like a 100-person line and there'd be nobody at the other craft beer bars at the different booths. I mean, you know, there'd be a scant people around drinking beer and we'd have like 100 people in the kombucha line. And so we had all these people demanding the product, but we didn't have the grocery store buy-in or the bar buy-in yet. And so it took a while to really build the trust of the grocery store buyer and the bar, you know, the craft beer kind of bartender and bar buyer to understand that this was something that people wanted. So it was an uphill climb for a bit.
Yeah. Did you find that at those events when you had those long lines, was there a specific demographic you found that was really driving some of that demand from consumers? Like, for example, is it like a Gen Z thing or something like that? Kind of like the White Claw movement or whatever, where kind of younger audiences were driving it because they wanted something different than, you know, the typical craft beer stuff? Or was it just people who loved kombucha were excited about a hard kombucha?
We were really surprised at the events. That was one of the big takeaways at doing events, that we were really surprised by the demographic because it was everyone. You know, I was like, there was older people, younger people, across all ages. We were kind of expecting the core demographic to be this like yoga mom or like younger, you know, like kind of like 30 to 25 to 40 year old, like, you know, female that lives in Encinitas. And we were really surprised that across the board, there was just like, there was a lot of demand across all demographics, across, you know, and there was some people like the kind of classic craft beer guy that was at the craft beer event. They had to maybe get dragged over to the booth by their girlfriend and be like, honey, you have to taste this. And then, but when they would taste it, everybody was sold. When we would finally get it in someone's hands and they'd be willing to try it, everybody was sold. So we just knew that that was our marketing strategy. It was just get the product in people's hands.
Get it in people's hands. Yeah.
That was how we built the business. You know, by the time COVID rolled around, when we had to shut down the event side of our business for quite a while, we were doing, you know, thousands. We were getting kombucha into hundreds of thousands of people's hands every year through tasting and sampling at events.
Smart. I mean, when you're trying to create a new category, it's just, you know, get it out there. People don't know what it is, get it in their mouth and they'll see why they want it. But it's funny, like fast forward to today, now I feel like it's hard to go to a craft beer bar without some sort of hard kombucha on tap, right? It's kind of similar with cider. Like, it was hard to find hard ciders for a long time, but then as the gluten-free movement or whatever grew, all of a sudden hard cider exploded, and now you have bars dedicated to cider and cideries are exploding. And then I feel like kombucha was kind of right on the tails of that, because it was almost like a cider-like experience for people who wanted a little alcohol, but maybe weren't into IPAs or whatever else was on tap, right?
Yeah, and it was interesting. At first, you know, the bars would finally bring Butchcraft on and they would sell a lot of it. So then we would see this bar like, wow, they're really selling a lot of Butchcraft. They're obviously going to keep us on. But then as competition started coming in, you know, we started birthing, you know, stepchildren and stuff that came from, you know, ex-brewers of ours starting kombucha breweries and ex-marketers of ours starting hard kombucha breweries, you know, like Juneshine being a really prevalent one in San Diego that came up out of one of our ex-brewers helping to start that brand. We would see this trend of like, you know, they would go in and convince the bar to put Juneshine on tap, then we would go back in and convince them to put Butchcraft on tap. And, you know, we realized kind of after a while, like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why does this bar with 15, 20 taps only have one hard kombucha and they keep rotating back and forth between Juneshine and Butchcraft? Like, they really should have two of them based on the revenue that they're generating from this one tap. They really need to have two hard kombucha taps. So we started pushing really hard for like, hey, you don't need to switch out us and the other hard kombucha that you have on tap. Just put us on in addition to that one, or put them on in addition to us, because people want choices and they want, you know, they want options. And we're starting to see that more, especially with the bars that were selling a lot of hard kombucha. We're starting to see like two hard kombuchas on tap, which is nice, because then same with the grocery stores. It was like, there's this little hard kombucha, you know, this teeny little section with like just a couple of Butchcrafts in the sections immersed in gluten-free beer and cider and stuff. And now we're starting to see like whole sections of hard kombucha where it's like every brand is in there and they've got all the SKUs lined up, and people know that they can go to the grocery store now and like they can find that kind of hard kombucha section, which is what we need for the category to really become a category and not just like a small little trend that goes away after a while.
Yeah. And that's why it kind of takes time. Like they always, people joke about the 20 year overnight success. And part of it is when you're creating a new category of something, it takes a long time just to get some saturation in the market, to change retailer mindsets, to drive consumer demand, to get it in the habits of so many people, et cetera. And that just takes time to build up, right? But like you started this kind of movement a while ago, and now it's picking up steam, but there's still a lot of room to grow, right? That's kind of a cool story, and I feel like we could geek out on Butchcraft for an entire episode, but we're going to shift into Pacha now. And part of the reason for discussing the Butchcraft and some of your previous experiences, just kind of like plant these seeds about your passion for food and your experience in CPG. So with that said, your latest brand is Pacha, that's gluten-free, sprouted, fermented bread. So what inspired this venture, and you know, where are you in the business stage / how's it going right now?
Yeah. So Pacha, for one, you know, I was at Butchcraft. I was basically, we have hired executives on kind of every level of the business, marketing and finance. And some of the roles that I was fulfilling at Butchcraft was like running the marketing and doing the finance. And so we have kind of hired executive level team at all of those roles, and found myself still doing the impact stuff, working with nonprofits, doing our B Corp certification, things like that, which we just got certified as a B Corp at Butchcraft. And so, you know, doing some things that were really important to us and to me, and also finding that I had more time and was able to focus my attention on something, on another project, while my business partner Todd is still the CEO over there at Butchcraft and running the company.
Yeah.
And also wanting to, you know, get back into food. My passion really is for food. I enjoyed launching a beverage company, but my truest passion really is about food and regenerative agriculture, and which we could maybe talk about later. But I was at a retreat. The way it all started was I was at a retreat out in Mount Shasta, and someone brought this bread to this retreat that I was at, and I fell in love with it immediately. I was just like, wow, this is the most incredible,
yeah,
most incredible like gluten-free bread that I've ever had. And so, you know, slowly started working with the people that were there at the retreat and the people that brought the bread, and saying like, hey, let's develop this, let's work on this, and was just purchasing it from them over, you know, for a while. And then at one point, the guy that was making it left town and his girlfriend was still in town, and there was all this stuff happening. And I was like kind of more pushing them like, hey, you guys should like grow this into something bigger. I'm too busy over here at Butchcraft to do anything with it. And then there's a local restaurant called Trilogy Sanctuary who was also kind of like, hey, we should do something together. Like, this bread is awesome. We should, you know, maybe build a brand off of something, you know, here at the restaurant. And all this time I was just overwhelmed with my work at Butchcraft. And yeah, then slowly I started opening up, freeing up some more time, and seeing that nothing was happening with the bread brand. You know, it was just, it had basically died on the vine, and the guy had left town. It was in a different country and wasn't coming back to do anything with it. And then his girlfriend was actually now a co-owner of Trilogy Sanctuary, which was the restaurant that also wanted to launch something. So I decided it was time to just, you know, move forward and like, let's make this bread brand happen. Trilogy was interested, and I had free time, and I really felt like it wasn't just my own, you know, I felt like the gluten-free market was kind of, it was just not interesting. Everything that was happening in the gluten-free bread market, it was like these, all these breads that were trying to kind of mimic white bread. And I was like, I don't really want to replace my white bread with white bread. You know, like, I don't want to, I'm not trying to eat something that tries to taste as much like it has gluten in it, yeah, but never can taste like it has gluten in it, because gluten is this magical thing that, you know, while it might be detrimental to health for some people, it has these magical properties that you just can't imitate. So I was like, let's launch this bread and really create a new kind of gluten-free bread category within the gluten-free category here. Let's try not to imitate this thing anymore, but do something different. And so we partnered with Trilogy Sanctuary and with all of the owners there, and myself and my partner, my wife, Maddie, we all got together and we just started making it happen. We started meeting up. Same thing. We were like, okay, let's put some money down. Let's fund an account. Let's just start making bread and selling it. And right when we started doing that, COVID hit. Like, it was like literally the day that our lease started in the commercial kitchen. It was April 1st, 2020, and COVID hit. And, you know, some people were like, oh man, that wasn't good timing. But I was like, this is great timing, because not only could we really focus, all of us could really focus on this, you know, this project. People were looking for different food and they weren't necessarily like wanting to go to the grocery store. So we started doing like a bread pickup at our house, actually. So we launched, we sent emails out to like everyone in the community that we knew from all of our email lists. We blasted out the community and we said, hey, we're making this awesome organic gluten-free bread. It's available for pickup once a week in Ocean Beach. Like, you can come get it. Just place your orders, pre-order by this date, and we'll have your bread ready for you. And so, yeah, it was kind of like a bread CSA, and people were buying bread. And, you know, even though they weren't getting to interact with people a lot because COVID was, they were locked down, they were getting to come to our house and like have this little fun interaction and get their bread every week. And then we started doing the farmer's market when the farmer's market came back online. And then shortly after that, we started like finding inroads to grocery stores and started pitching grocery stores. And meanwhile, we're cooking everything in, you know, a 350 square foot kitchen, but we're pitching like Whole Foods Global, you know, like, I don't know what's going to happen if they say yes, but, you know, we'll figure it out, I guess. So we were kind of simultaneously trying to figure out how to scale the production and also pitching all of the grocery stores that we thought would be a good fit and still selling locally and selling to local accounts like People's Co-op in Ocean Beach. And Trilogy Sanctuary was, you know, one of our partners, but also a big customer of ours. And they were helping us test the bread and, you know, put it on their menu and then see what the feedback was and iterate the bread. So it was kind of just for me, I felt like it was the perfect opportunity to create and innovate. You know, I think a lot of people in those situations think like it's time to scale back and like pull away. But for me, like, those times are times to like innovate and reinvent and really push out and create something new.
Yeah. I mean, it's invention is, I'm spacing on the phrase, but it's like you kind of get forced into being innovative based on the time and place that you're launching something, right? So I feel like times like COVID or times where recession hits or somebody gets laid off or, you know, like whatever, but it's some sort of big life or world kind of event that can often change the circumstances just enough for people to take some risk. And then you also hear those people saying that if you're the one marketing through a downturn, you'll be the one on the top when the economy comes back to life, right? So it's scary when everything's pulling back to like drive forward and dig in deeper. But often when you do, you're going to be able to carve out a little bit more market territory than people who pulled back during that time. So it is interesting come launching in a recession or pandemic. Actually, like, my design studio is the same kind of thing. We launched it in 2009 at the bottom of the economy, and it was actually beneficial to us because there were a lot of bigger agencies struggling to keep staff on, and there were a lot of companies who couldn't afford the big agencies but would love to work with a smaller agency, et cetera, and it kind of like bloomed from there, you know. So anyway, there's always some good that comes out of the bad, I think. So with that said, I know when you're selling in kind of a baked goods and trying to go to retail, one of the biggest struggles is shelf life, because I was talking to some grocery store buyer and I think they said something to the effect of like 50% of the baked goods they buy don't get sold, but before they go stale or something like that. So there's just a lot of loss in that category. So I've heard of people trying different methods of like, well, maybe if we sell par baked in this vacuum sealed bag, or maybe if we sell frozen, or if we you know, whatever different kind of strategies. So I know that you are also in compostable packaging, or at least the kind of inner wrap, which also can have shelf life issues. So therefore, you sell frozen to keep it fresh without preservatives and to extend shelf life, which makes sense. But that comes with its own challenges of distribution. Now you got to distribute like cold chain, which is probably more expensive and complicated. But then also, you've got to be in kind of a freezer case or something instead of in the bakery aisle, which also is a challenge to make sure that people go there. I think luckily gluten-free people are used to going there, but I think you're trying to reach a wider audience too. So can you talk about some of these challenges of selling like a baked good into retail, but also like challenges of compostable or being in the freezer case versus the bakery, et cetera? I imagine that you've had to deal with a lot there.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. The choice to go with like frozen, vacuum sealed and frozen was kind of like the only real option for trying to have a national brand in with a bread. You know, we weren't trying to be a fresh baked bread that delivered locally to every grocery store and, you know, like little shop, you know, with fresh baked bread every morning. That just wasn't the vision. We wanted to get this brand out to the whole country and be national in grocery stores. So, you know, with the grocery distribution, like the good thing is that there's plenty of frozen, refrigerated and frozen foods out there in grocery. And so that distribution chain and supply chain is really well established. So like kind of opposite of what we had to deal with Bootscraft, where like not everyone is distributing alcohol and beer cold. And we had to kind of like pioneer that a bit, like with Pacha, the distribution and frozen and refrigerated is really well established. And so our bread is sold to grocery stores frozen, but then they can choose to slack it out and put it in the fridge in the refrigerator door, or they can put it in the freezer door, depending on where they keep all their gluten-free bread. So we do have some options. Obviously, we prefer the refrigerator if that's an option, but if they only have the bread in the freezer, then that's where we go. And it doesn't move as much volume as like the ambient shelf, but we're never going to be in the ambient shelf. So we just have to kind of accept that and hope that more and more people learn that that's where we're at. What we did not really forecast was doing direct to consumer. Like we didn't really think about the fact that maybe we would sell a lot of bread through direct to consumer channel. And so that has been kind of a challenge of like figuring out how do we keep the bread cold enough? It can, you know, we can have it frozen and ship it out to people all over the country, but how do we keep it cold enough as well as, you know, have it stay good until it gets to them and still has like enough shelf life for them to enjoy the bread once they receive it? And so we've had all sorts of logistical nightmares and shipping and using all the different carriers and trying to figure out the right formula for what carrier to use for which shipments, because we're in San Diego going to the East Coast using like UPS Ground or USPS is really not viable because of the time it takes. And then trying to figure out like, you know, obviously we're using compostable packaging and we really, really care about not creating plastic trash. So in addition to having a home compostable certified vacuum sealed bag, we also don't want to use a bunch of plastic trash, like cooler insulated, like styrofoam boxes and whatnot. So we finally found an insulated box that has the insulation is made out of what can be put into water and become plant food. So it's like a nitrogen based insulation. Yeah, you can literally just put the insulation right into water. When it gets wet, it dissolves and you can like water your plants with it. And apparently it's also a really good drain declogger. So it's like a natural drain declogger. So you can pour it down the drain and just like if you live in an apartment and you don't have plants, you can just pour it down the drain and it helps to keep your drains clean. And then if you have plants, you can just pour it right on your plants. So that's actually a new product that we haven't started using yet, but we're about to start bringing that in-house. And so, yeah, that has been a challenge for sure. And then, of course, the vacuum seal bags. I mean, the compostable vacuum seal bags, while they're certified home compostable, they meet our values as far as like not creating plastic trash. Their shelf life is, they have a limited shelf life. They puncture easier. You know, we find ourselves like even having like little sharp corners on our bread or something. We have to grate, you know, little sharp corners off the edges of our bread. So, you know, I go in the thing and the guys are doing the process and there's a guy sitting there grating bread. And I'm like constantly thinking like, how are we going to scale this? Like, are we going to grate every thing? So just like finding little challenges like that, that's like, we obviously can't do this manually forever. We have to figure out a way to do this more automated. And then the vacuum seal bags, they can't be thermoformed, which is like when you think about vacuum sealing, you have two options. You have a pouch and you just place your product in the preformed pouch and then you close the thing. And that's how we currently do vacuum sealing. But the faster, more automated way is you have two rolls of film and they go down the line. And one of the rolls, the one on the bottom, gets heated and a little like pouch gets blown out with air and heat. And then as that goes by, you put the whatever the product is in that pouch and then the next layer goes on top and then they vacuum seal the whole thing. And so that's ideal. It's much faster, but that technology does not work in conjunction with compostable packaging. So we're kind of stuck with the pouch version right now. So we're moving forward under the assumption that we'll never be able to thermoform, although the technology might improve as more and more people start using compostable packaging. And that's our hope, is that it improves over time and we're able to use thermoforming.
Does the compostable, I assume it holds up fine in a freezer / fridge, by which I mean, I think that probably eliminates some of the shelf life worries with compostable, because I've had some clients like Regrained that had some struggles with the compostable packaging and shelf life issues that made the product go stale. So they've had to move out of compostable for the time being. But I think if you're in the fridge, then it's probably less of a concern, right?
Because yeah,
the fridge will keep it from decomposing.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to be fine. They seem to be holding up just fine. They technically have like a 1-year shelf life on the bags, but we haven't noticed any issues with the bags over time composting or decomposing or degrading or, you know, losing their efficacy. Yeah. We don't know completely yet. I mean, we haven't been able to do like long-term testing in the freezer so far. So there could be issues with shelf life long-term in the freezer, but our hope is to not have things sitting around for, you know, more than a year anyways. It's like, we want to freeze them, hold them for a couple months, sell them to a grocery store or to a consumer and get them out the door. So hopefully that's not really a concern. And then I think the biggest concern is heat with compostable packaging. And so if your product is ambient and then you're selling it through a distributor, they might put it into a truck and have it sit on like 100-degree truck for, you know, multiple days, or into a warehouse that's really hot, and they're not concerned about the heat because it's an ambient product. So that's where I think you run into problems with compostable packaging, is that they overheat and they start to like, they literally start to melt.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I've heard this say about like, well, you were talking about the bread having sharp corners and the bags puncturing, but like, I've also heard from Guayaki that they were doing compostable packages, but the material itself was also more stiff and it would create these sharp edges, and then bags would like poke each other in distribution, and then retailers would open up a bag of like mate all over the box. Yeah. Because they had, like, the bags got in a fight during shipping. So they've had to like work through some of those issues. But yeah, I think, you know, we need to move the world forward in terms of like use of plastic and packaging and different things, but it is a struggle, right? We've got to keep innovating and keep developing some of these technologies. Which reminds me, I did remember the quote that I was trying to get out earlier, is necessity is the mother of invention. So I feel like we're also at that point with things like packaging, is we're going to reach points where we just have to solve this, right? And hopefully more people start using compostable, even though maybe it's not ideal in every situation right now, but we've got to start using it, testing it, and finding solutions for some of these issues.
Yeah, for sure. We need the big brands to jump on board. You know, we need the Patagonias, but we also need the General Mills and the big brands to jump on board and see the value in this. And then the supply chain, the innovation and the money goes into the supply chain, and then the innovation gets better, the technology gets better, but then also the price comes down and it becomes more affordable.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one just super quick question, just because it's in my mind and maybe there it's in listeners' minds, but when you're selling into the baked goods, but you're also kind of a frozen product, are you dealing with the frozen buyer or the bakery buyer at a grocery store?
We're dealing with the frozen buyer if it's going into the freezer door, and then we're dealing with the like grocery refrigerated buyer if it's going into the refrigerator door. And sometimes we're pitching both of them if there's an option for both. It's kind of funny, like the frozen buyer, sometimes it's like, that's kind of what I was saying about like the trends, you know, with Butchcraft, like the buyers aren't always up with the trends. And we've seen that a lot with Pacha's, like we're talking to this frozen buyer that's like, they're buying frozen pizza and, you know, they're buying all these frozen foods. And so like, I think that they're more in this mindset of like, you know, frozen meals and frozen foods and frozen everything, and like gluten-free, you know, sustainably made bread with like compostable packaging and supporting regenerative agriculture. It's not like, they're like, oh yeah, that's what the consumer wants. They're thinking about frozen pizza. And so sometimes we're just talking to these buyers that don't realize that there is a huge demand for this product. They don't know because of the category that they're buying for.
Yeah, that makes sense. That can be a challenge. Sometimes I know one of our clients is a chocolate product that they could be pitching to just the chocolate shelf, but they often end up pitching to the kind of specialty section of the store because it's a very giftable kind of like more premium product. But you know, different kind of trends, different desires, different concerns from buyers in those two different categories. So it is a challenge kind of to meet the buyers where they're at and try to bring them along with whatever you're trying to sell. So shifting from here, so great intro into Pacha and some of the issues you're dealing with. But I know that part of the point behind Pacha is health, and I know you're kind of big into health as well. But I know it's also partly kind of a regenerative agriculture story too. That's a kind of passion subject of both of us, so I figured we'd geek out on that a little bit. So can you talk about how Pacha is kind of supporting the regenerative agriculture movement?
Yeah, so we specifically chose buckwheat as a main ingredient in our products because of its utility in regenerative agriculture. Buckwheat is a great cover crop. It's used to rotate in, you know, through other grains and other seeds, and it can be plowed back into the soil to create, you know, to create healthy soil. It's also a great pollinator, pollinator flower for bees. And so along with buckwheat, we have sunflower and some of our products, which is also a great pollinator flower and also used in regenerative agriculture for rotation. So we started with main ingredients that are very well used and utilized in regenerative agriculture. And our goal eventually is to, you know, buy certified regenerative buckwheat and sunflower and flax once the industry gets there and once there's enough quantity of certified product available. So yeah, really we want to support regenerative agriculture by, you know, purchasing certified regenerative ingredients. And then also on the back end with 1% for the planet, you know, we're supporting nonprofits that support regenerative agriculture and are educating future farmers about regenerative agriculture. So those are kind of the twofold piece of how we really want to go after and support regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, I noticed that on your website, you mentioned in like your own custom graphic, 1% for the planet, and then like a note of regenerative agriculture. So I assume that's where you do most of your giving. But I didn't notice the 1% for the planet, like specific, you know, mark on the website or on packaging. But with that said, you know, we met through 1% for the planet. So I know you're a big supporter there, but what are like some examples of some of the organizations you've supported specifically through 1%, and how are you supporting them? Are you donating product, time, money, kind of partnering with them on events or anything else like that?
Yeah, so we're still pretty small, you know, as a brand, and with our revenue not being massive, so we don't have a ton of resources to give yet. But we've started out partnering with the Ecology Center in San Juan Capistrano, and the Ecology Center is like the most incredible. They're a certified regenerative organic nonprofit farm. They're 27 acres. They have a ton of different programs there, one of which is a farmer education program where they're educating potentially future farmers or existing farmers in regenerative practices, but then also helping to incubate the farmers, helping them start their own regenerative farm, giving them resources, helping their with the supply chain and distribution. So that's kind of one of our favorite programs that they do. But they also have a program where they're getting regeneratively grown food out to people who are food insecure. They have like 750 CSA members, and I think like 200 or something of those members are food insecure that receive free boxes. And recently they've been doing prepared foods because oftentimes the people receiving the boxes like don't know what to do with the stuff or don't have the time to cook everything. And so they've been including or switching out instead of boxes, doing like taking the food and preparing prepared food and sending that their way. They also have a full-time school for children from kindergarten or preschool through high school, and the children are learning on the farm like full-time, just learning about everything they're learning, and they're doing it through nature and through farming, which I love. That, you know, to me, like one of the biggest things we can do is educate our future generations, and get not only future generations and stoked about farming, but also just about consuming food that is grown regeneratively and caring about where it comes from. And future policymakers and future politicians, everyone, those kids are the future, you know, that will be making those decisions. And then, yeah, we do events with them. We've donated a little bit of money and product. And so our hope is to grow that relationship. And, you know, as we grow, potentially we would also work with other nonprofits. But, you know, that's for us right now, like we want to focus our giving in one place because we have so little to give right now.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Maybe as you grow / have space to collaborate with other groups, one thought is maybe doing some work with CCOF, because I know they've got their certification program and they're able to certify regenerative organic, but I know they also do a lot of education and thought leadership and stuff through their foundation around organic and other kind of policies. So I imagine they could be an interesting partner to do something with it as well.
Yeah, we're actually certified with CCOF, and I've talked with them on the foundation side as well. And we've done a ton of this work with Bootscraft and our 1% giving, supporting Kiss the Ground, the Regenerative Organic Alliance, Perennial Farm Alliance. The Ecology Center is kind of our main focus right now with Bootscraft. So we've done a ton of work in the regenerative agriculture space. So it was really nice coming into, you know, Pacha and kind of thinking about our giving there and having had the experience of working with a lot of different nonprofits and different programs that are all aligned in supporting regenerative agriculture, but all doing it in different ways. And having had that experience and those relationships, you know, I feel really well prepared for, you know, figuring out the giving side on Pacha.
Yeah, and I appreciate that your giving right now is kind of supporting farmer support and education, et cetera, to grow the supply chain, because I know there's a pretty big growing movement around people excited about and ready for kind of regenerative agriculture and wanting to move in that direction. But then there's just limited supply right now, right? So even if you're trying, if you had the option, you would be like all regenerative organic ingredients or something like that. But almost no company out there has the option right now to get all their ingredients regenerative organic. It's hard enough to get one ingredient regenerative organic certified just because it's so new right now. So I think to help kind of grow that movement, we need to support the farmers and make sure that we're converting more land, not only to organic, but also to regenerative, so that we can actually have truly regenerative products on shelf.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, we're buying our buckwheat from a local mill in the Midwest that's certified organic and that's bringing in, that's also, that certifies gluten-free because of our gluten-free certification. And they're sourcing all of the organic buckwheat from, you know, farms all around the Midwest. And so there are farms that we're buying from that are, you know, using regenerative practices. And we can't say that this little grain of buckwheat came from that farm and that one came from this one. But, you know, we do know that they're all organic and that some of them are practicing regenerative agriculture. We just need the certification to become more prolific so that we can actually say, okay, yes, we know that these, you know, this buckwheat is coming from a regenerative farm versus, you know, more traditional organic farm.
And I have faith and hope that the movement is coming along quickly, purely because just even this year we've been putting the regenerative organic certified logo on like 2 or 3 of our clients' packaging. So I feel like it's just starting to pick up steam and more people are getting certified, more options are out there, et cetera. So hopefully over the coming like 5 years or so, it'll pick up even more steam and we'll start having the supply chain solidly there and more brands with that regenerative organic seal on the front. So I know we could geek out probably forever on regenerative stuff as well, but I know we're kind of getting close to time. So I'd love to wrap up with a little bit of kind of advice for others, because this isn't your first rodeo, so to speak. You know, you've worked in restaurants and catering, you've kind of done marketing, e-commerce, all sorts of things, and you've launched and helped grow Bootscraft, and you're kind of working on Pacha. So you've got quite a bit more experience than the average CPG entrepreneur, I think. So what advice would you offer to others looking to follow in your footsteps? Like maybe some major lessons learned along the way, things you've realized you shouldn't focus on, or things you realize you really should focus on early on in a business?
It's a great question. And I also, you know, I think about this quite often. And, you know, one of the big things, I think there's a number of things that I think are really important that I've learned on the journey. And first and foremost is to pick something that you're passionate about, but don't expect to be passionate about like every aspect of the business. You have to wear a lot of hats. You have to do the admin stuff and the finance and the marketing and the sales, and you might not like some of it. For me, it's like you need to be passionate about the core aspect of the business, like the product that you're making or the service that you're delivering, and then realize that there are all the jobs that exist in the business to keep it running that you might not be passionate about, and you might have to do them for a little while. So like find something that you're passionate about, but also like don't expect that everything is going to be super exciting, like, you know, data entry or whatever. So, and I still do all the admin stuff for Pacha to this day. So at some point I'll pass it off, but I think it's also I really enjoy building the systems and doing a lot of the jobs and understanding the jobs before passing them off, and then knowing like what to expect and knowing how to train someone and all of that's really helpful. And then, you know, secondly, I think really being able to like be okay and like learn to listen to and follow your intuition and your gut and not overanalyze before making decisions sometimes. You know, like I think it's great to find data and to look at data and to look at trends and to do surveys and do all these things. But, you know, true innovation can't come out of a data set or a survey, because people they're not going to tell you that they wanted, you know, hard kombucha before hard kombucha existed. And they're not going to tell you that they wanted, you know, this like CD bread before the CD bread existed. Like you have to kind of like really follow your intuition and come up with ideas and think like, okay, like, does this feel right? And then start to do it and then start to implement data and surveys and like tastings and things as you go, rather than trying to accumulate the data before making the decision to move forward. So I really think like there's an element in entrepreneurship that's just like constantly stepping into blind faith. And people, I know there's a lot of people that say, no, never step into blind faith, like do your research. But for me, like some of the best decisions I've made and like have been blind faith step, blind faith step, blind faith step. And then while like all the while, like gathering data, listening to the signals and thinking like, oh wait, maybe we should actually go over here or do this thing. And just kind of like constantly throwing things on the wall and seeing what sticks and like listening to the feedback. You know, it's like, I think you can get yourself into trouble when you go on intuition and then you're not willing to listen to the feedback because you're so attached to doing that thing that you decided to do versus being okay with being wrong and like, oh, wow, I chose to do this and, you know, that wasn't right, but actually led me to this other option that is really like the way to go. And I think that's the move, is to just stay flexible and make decisions and be nimble and just like take steps after steps that seem like, you know, potentially blind faith and all the while kind of being willing to lose everything. Like that's kind of been my whole mantra throughout all of my businesses, is like going all in, like financially and emotionally and like with my time, and then being willing to say like, okay, like worst case scenario, I lose everything and I start over and do something else, or I figure it out. You know, like I feel confident that I have the ability to like to start over if I need to. So having that sense of trust that I'm willing to lose everything. And that to me is like what makes other people excited to jump on board too. Like business partners and employees, they're like, wow, this person is like, they're all in and they're willing to put everything in and they're going to be putting 100% of their energy into this thing because they don't want to, you know, to lose everything, but they're willing to. So that's been a big lesson for me too.
Yeah, there's so many awesome nuggets of wisdom in there. I was trying to take some notes for that. But yeah, touch on real quick, like your kind of follow your gut note kind of reminds me of episode 31. I was just quickly looking up which episode it was, but we have an episode called Cultivating Heartset in this kind of series of like leadership conversations I have with the guys at Subtle Distinctions, which is a kind of coaching business. But anyway, in that episode, they kind of talked about the value of heartset, because we often talk about mindset or skill sets or other things like that as necessary for business, but we don't often talk about heartset, which is kind of more of like trusting your gut, knowing where your passion's taking you, et cetera, sometimes having to ignore data if the data's wrong or the data doesn't exist yet or whatever, and kind of lean in on those areas and kind of cultivating that heart set as much as you're cultivating your mindset and your skill set, so that you can learn when to use which. Because sometimes, yeah, data is important. If you're a giant international corporation about to launch a $1 billion new brand, you're probably going to want some data to back that up to make sure that it's not a complete flop or you're going in the wrong direction. But often when you're a scrappy, passionate entrepreneur, you're probably creating something that there would be no data on because, you know, people don't know what that thing is yet. So you've got to just follow your own gut and kind of take those, like you said, baby steps of try something, see how it worked, try another thing, see how that worked, and kind of move forward in that sort of bootstrap prototype kind of methodology to where you've just got to lean in on your gut and then, but like you said, be receptive to pivoting when the data is not showing up for you as you start testing stuff. So I think that was really good advice. And I also kind of reminded me of, I can't remember the list that I saw, but I want to say it was like some sort of Inc. or Forbes or Entrepreneur or whatever kind of magazine list of the like top CEOs in the country, and it had a bunch of data on each of them. And I seem to remember like most of the CEOs that people just know offhand, like Amazon or Tesla, you know, like all these people, most of them never got business training, or at least not before launching their business. But then there's all these big corporations with like Harvard MBAs or whatever leading them. And I feel like those MBAs often come in after a founder like gets it off the ground running. But like often that Harvard MBA is so stuck on needing data and case studies and all this kind of stuff that they're probably not going to be the one that's going to innovate a whole new category or turn a business around. Like they're going to be the one that can maintain a business or maybe scale it slightly year over year. But the mindset that's needed is almost that naive, like I don't know enough to be cautious, but I know just enough to try some things and move forward. So sometimes that kind of naivete in business is super valuable because you're going to come in with fresher ideas and not a lot of limitations and just try some stuff that might actually work, but there's no data there to back it up. So if you came in a little bit more cautious, you're probably not going to innovate. Anyway, so there's a place and time for all skill sets, but I feel like what you were talking on reminded me of that Heart Set episode. So anyone interested in hearing more about that, check out episode 31. And then I also loved your kind of go all in note as well, because it's, I feel like a lot of people dabble in things on the side and then get frustrated with how slow the growth is. But it's slow because you don't have the time or bandwidth to move it forward, right? But if you take some time to go all in and test and really test an idea out, you'll be surprised at how much quicker you can move it. I should probably look up the episode number 2, but there was another episode where we kind of talked about that, of like just take a year or 2 years or whatever, just set a time and just go all in on your project for a little while. Give yourself a timestamp and say, if I don't have it figured out by this date, then I'll know I need to move on or try something else. But at least you give yourself that time to really try it out. So anyway, smart advice. The one about kind of understanding your passion is powerful too. I feel like we've touched on that in multiple episodes as well. So anyway, great stuff all across the board. Again, I feel like we could geek out on many more episodes going into detail in some of these other conversations we had, but I know we're kind of stretching the clock here. So I'll just stop there with that great advice. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for doing what you do and helping kind of move industries forward, whether it's food or regenerative agriculture or health or whatever else. I think you're doing some really powerful and important work, and I appreciate you taking a little bit of time out to come and share that story with us.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to have to send you some bread so we can give you a taste of the pacha bread as well.
Yeah, I'd love to. You got some like beautiful photography on the website of like the bread and sandwiches are used as like bruschetta or other things like that. It looked like, so lots of cool things that you're doing with the bread, and I'm looking forward to trying it. Looks delicious.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to share and to have conversations about this type of stuff. I'm actually, you know, also really passionate about not just food, but also like business, you know, kind of entrepreneurship and leadership and things of that nature as well. So it's really fun to come and chat with you.
Awesome. And anyone that's still hanging on, check out episode 47 with Kayla Castaneda of Agua Bonita. The episode's called Nailing the Pitch, but that one was one of those episodes where we talked about going all in, because she just gave it like a year and just went all in and was hoping that at the end of the year it would be working, and it does seem to be working. So anyway, Lots of good stuff. Again, appreciate it. And thanks again. Cheers.
Thanks, bud.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Adam or Pacha, go to livepacha.com. If you like this show, remember to help us grow by liking, reviewing, and sharing. If you're new here, don't forget we have over 100 episodes in the archive. Some might be called Evolve CPG, but it's the same show, so dig in for more goodness. If you consider yourself an impact-driven professional, join me over at impactdriven.community, where we're supporting each other's growth as impact leaders.